Greetings, ladies. Good day, gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in to Red Ice Radio. I'm your host, Henrik Palmgren, from Götaland, Sweden. This program is dedicated to dispelling the mythmakers and stands as a beacon of sanity in a world full of lies and deceit, secret agendas and ruthless warfare tactics that is aimed towards our ultimate destruction. We talk with authors, researchers, academics, filmmakers, journalists, and many others, both friend and foe, in an effort to find out, discover truth, and make you aware of as much as possible of the most important and valuable topics that you just have to know about. We hope you benefit from the discussions, find them challenging, engaging, and that they will make you think, question, and then finally take action. Today we're talking with Professor Ricardo Duchesne. He teaches sociology and world history at the University of New Brunswick in St. John, Canada. His publications include one book, 45 referred articles, one chapter, 13 encyclopedia entries, and 18 non-referred articles. His book, The Uniqueness of Western Civilization, a major work of 528 pages, was something we discussed in detail last time we had him with us. Currently, he's doing research on multiculturalism and the identity crisis of the West. In this program, we'll begin to speak about the recent charges that was made against him for breaking the law of the cultural Marxists and politically correct academics by challenging the guilt they seek to impose on Canadians and all other Europeans around the world, for that matter, too. We'll speak about how this was brought into the mainstream Canadian media recently and if his university position now is threatened because of it. We'll get into much more later in the program about the multicultural model in Canada, immigration, national suicide, the history of migrations, colonization, massive population movements, population growth, and a whole lot more. We had a great show last time you were with us. We were talking about your latest book, The Uniqueness of Western Civilization. Welcome back, Ricardo. Hope you're doing well.
Yes, I'm very pleased to be here again and to be able to talk more about the issues that we started talking about last time. I think there's so many things that one can talk about, so I appreciate this opportunity.
Thank you, Ricardo. Well, quite a bit has happened since you last with us. There's been quite a bit of run-ins with you at the University in New Brunswick. There's, I guess, some people who've gotten their eyes open to some of the critique that you've been starting to toss around as well. Have your position in any way been threatened, Ricardo, due to what you've been talking about and writing about in the last few years here?
No, I think ultimately it has not been threatened. What has happened is that in situations like this, someone makes a complaint from the outside, and then the university follows through or takes it seriously, and all the things of that nature, there is always a pressure on you to back off, to limit your arguments, and to think twice next time. And that did happen. There is no question about it. But overall, the university realizes that I'm still operating within the freedom that I'm afforded in the university as an academic. So I would say that things are going fine at the university, even though they did sort of manage in a kind of indirect way to give me a sense that I have to be careful.
Oh, boy. Well, I mean, I take that as yet another example and a sign of the times we are in terms of the restrictedness of academia and the fact that if you do offer a counter perspective, if you do offer some balance to the incredibly skewed position that academia has been in since the 60s at least, then, you know, if you go against the grain, you'll feel that pretty quick. It's a kind of a sad state of affairs, though, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I always think that one of the most Orwellian phrases that has ever been devised is the idea that universities are engaged in critical thinking. This is a phrase that is repeated regularly by academics. And in reality, there is very little critical thinking going on in university nowadays. You could argue that some critical thinking was going on in the 1960s because cultural Marxism had not at that point in time come to penetrate and assert itself in the way eventually did. But now that every facet, feature and institution in our society is heavily influenced by the goals of cultural Marxism, you cannot say that by asserting and promoting yet more cultural Marxism that you are engaging critical thinking, the more so because the kind of critical thinking that they're advocating precludes other ways of thinking that challenge directly cultural Marxism. And so we can talk about that later on, and this is in a sense what happened to me, because one of the things that this form of critical thinking precludes is the idea that you can talk about the ethnic identity and interests of Europeans or whites. So when you talk or use the language of ethnic pride, ethnic identity on the part of whites, they really react and oppose it and think that's unacceptable. So yes, the university is a very close-minded environment. People don't notice it because they take it for granted, and they have really managed to create the illusion that we are at the forefront of new ideas, new ways of thinking, and people have bought into that. Although I do see some people on the outside that are clearly the right-wing liberals, that's one thing they should be given credit for, is that they do know that universities don't allow for their own right-wing liberal ideas. Even people advocating those ideas are not plentiful in universities. You find them more in the United States, but in Canada they're very, very rare. And less so people who go beyond the right-wing critique of cultural Marxism, although I call the right-wing liberal of cultural Marxism as well, but
right. Yep.
I'll leave that for later.
Yep.
Clearly, you're coming from an old conservative point of view, a new right point of view, you're asserting European ethnicity. That really is not visible at all in our universities.
Well, exactly. I mean, these academics used to be so-called revolutionaries and rebels, but today they're just basically supporting the establishment view. They're pretty much in line with the current politics. Maybe there are a couple of kind of disagreements about some of the surface level stuff, but I mean the cultural Marxists have really imposed their line of thinking and their cultural framework upon the academic environment, and it's been there for I'd say half a decade now. So I mean, in this case, you are the rebel, Ricardo. I mean, you are the revolutionary one that is now fighting, and many others like you that are trying to, kind of change the culture to a certain extent from within. So that's important to have those dissenting voices that I want people to understand that, of continually, critiquing their critique, etc. And this is a process that has to continue. Otherwise, it stagnates and we end up in a really dangerous position, you know?
Yes, I mean... obviously, as you know, they don't see me as a person who's challenging the status quo, but as someone who hasn't fully understood what they're about, who doesn't appreciate the new freedoms as they see them that have been achieved, who is backward and retrograde and cannot understand or live in a society that is full of diversity and so on. And another aspect that allows them to pretend that they're engage in ideas whereby there is other ways of thinking is that, I mean, they're not totally homogeneous in the sense that you will have varying schools of thought within this cultural Marxist way of thinking. You will have people who are closer to Derrida, others who are closer to Foucault. Then there are the feminists, and then there are people who are engaged in specialized research that you might say fits in within the standard liberal tradition. Then there are the hardcore economic Marxists. So you have these kinds of variations within this monopoly of cultural Marxism that creates a semblance of diversity. And then they talk about the diversity of some academics who are gay and those who are not and who are of a different ethnicity and so on. So that allows them to create this wrong impression. But you really realize how close-minded they are when you challenge them from the outside, from a truly outside perspective, and that's what happened or has happened in my case.
Well, exactly. I mean, one of the things, and we'll talk more about this kind of left-center, right unison and everything what's happened there. I want to talk specifically more later about the Canadian model of multiculturalism and immigration that seems to be kind of as an attempt to be exported to other parts of the world and Europe specifically as well. And we'll talk more about that later. But one of the things that you were looking at was how certain people within the Vancouver City Council, for example, had urged the council to kind of create a staff to investigate what they called discriminatory laws and policies that they claimed was imposed by whites on Chinese immigrants in I guess it's specifically within the city between, 1886 and 1947 or something like that. And you brought up some really good examples that demonstrated otherwise, of course. And now this is an effort to, I don't know, is it to get reparations and get money out of the situation? What's their goal with critiquing these old laws, Ricardo?
Well, my sense, as I argue in the first essay that I wrote on this issue of requesting apologies from the Vancouver City, and I say Vancouver City because readers or listeners may not know, but the federal government in Canada in 2006 already apologized and directed millions towards some form of reparation towards the head tax that had been imposed late in the 19th century and through into the first decades of the 20th century. So there had been a federal apology. And then this May, sometime in mid-May, the provincial government, the British Columbia provincial government, also issued an apology, deep sorrow and regret for what they had done in the past. And what happened, and this is where I come in because I was just creating my blog when this was happening, the leaders, the Chinese leaders in Vancouver City, which is in British Columbia, did not accept this apology coming from the provincial government. And one of the reasons they gave as to why they did not accept this apology is that it wasn't sincere enough that the BC politicians, the British Columbia politicians, were playing ethnic politics. They were issuing this apology in order to gain the ethnic vote. And there is truth to this. I mean, politicians are opportunistic. They'll do whatever it takes to get votes.
Yeah.
But what I realized is that this may have been a reason why they did not accept the apology, but I think there is a deeper intention in rejecting this apology, and it is that Chinese leaders, really what they want is a moral apology, if you could put it this way. A term they use is inclusive redress, and I explain what that means in the first article I wrote on this issue in the blog, and what I thought that it means is that you're requesting whites to redress, to transcend, overcome the past wrongs they did by issuing an apology whereby you portray the Chinese as victims in need of reparation, which then elevates the cultural status of the Chinese today and keeps the whites in a state of, guilt, in a psychological state of having to engage in cultural reparation. So the issue is not just about financial reparation, but there is something going on here that you might call cultural reparation. And I wrote this article, and then I sent it to some of the Chinese leaders in Vancouver City, the ones who were calling for this investigation redress, because then the Vision Party, which is a municipal party that is in power in Vancouver, then went on to say that there should be extensive investigation as to every recrimination or act of discrimination that the whites had committed from, they said, from 1880 something to 1947, and it should be a thorough investigation, and there should be no limits to the time and the effort that would be put into investigating this. So this is what the municipal government called for. So I sent that article to the people who, the councilors, who happen to be Chinese, who initiated this policy of federal investigations into discrimination against the Chinese. I sent it to them, and one of them, Kelly Yan, replied to me by email. And then I wrote another article in which I responded to his arguments. And it sort of developed from that into further arguments and emails and so on. And from there, he did call the president of my university to complain.
Right, yeah.
I don't know exactly what was his complaint, how he worded it, but this was then something that was presented in an article in the news, and I was interviewed, and you can find this in the web. And, yeah, so it was good because it got the web that I developed going in a dynamic way right away, so I have no problems with that. But it was an interesting debate, and I am still going to go back to it, and it's still going on in some ways.
Yeah, well, exactly. There's a lot there. But, I mean, let's face it, most people in Canada alive today, they have been born after 1947. So why should European Canadians feel guilt and have to pay money back for something that they were not part of? What is the deal with this collective punishment? Let's talk about that guilt aspect to this a little bit more.
Yeah, it is absurd. I mean, I made that point that essentially you're asking a generation today of Europeans to pay for something that was committed many decades ago, and they're going to pay to a generation of Chinese who did not suffer from this head tax, many of whom have just arrived recently into Vancouver and British Columbia. So the whole thing really is just insane. And I basically am saying to whites themselves, look, you're going to have to start showing some pride in your heritage and history, because there nobody's going to give you that. And right now we have all these cultural Marxists in control of the media who have accepted this idea that we need to apologize for our history. Because in one of the articles that I wrote, I tried to examine the historical context within which this head tax was imposed. And it was a head tax that was imposed in the context of cheap labor arriving into Canada, cheap Chinese labor arriving and outcompeting the higher wage labor of Europeans. And if you're a socialist and you care for your own people and workers, well, I think you should be making that point. But academics are not making that point. The people who are outside academia, and I find that interesting that they call themselves socialists, quite a few academics say, but they don't defend the high wage demands of workers in British Columbia and Vancouver against the cheaper labor of the Chinese. So this was another issue that I brought forth in regards to this head tax or apology controversy.
Yep, exactly. I think you argued as well that the situations weren't that bad that they claimed. This is something that they kind of exacerbated in order to get more out of the situation, right? It was a little bit of discussions in terms of, was it real estate and ownership of certain, you know, things or whatnot that was restricted, but it turned out that it was actually quite a bit of Chinese people that owned real estate nonetheless, correct?
Yes, well, going back to the issue of white guilt and this apology, what has happened is that the way in which the history of the European settlers is presented in Canada is obviously negative. And I cite in one of the articles an Indian woman in Canada in which she says that there is nothing for the settlers to be proud of, because what they did was to engage in acts of extermination, colonialism, and so on. And so I am challenging that as well, that there is a point at which, Nietzsche has this expression or idea in which he says that you cannot have a history in which you're always second-guessing, questioning your past and looking at your mistakes and feeling bad about it. There's a point at which you're just going to have to push that to the side and look forward to the problems that you're facing currently. But in a sense, he's saying that you cannot build a nation by criticizing what you have done in the past, but you may simply just say, well, that's just the way it was, and there was no other alternative, and I would like to talk about the great things that the settler people accomplished here in Canada. And I think that this is done in Canadian universities and schools. They don't give them, they can't do that, because now we have all this racially mixed student body, and they don't want to make the whites feel pride in their history, so they just engage in history that is full of guilt.
Well, exactly. There's a lot to it there, of course, but you referenced Nietzsche a little bit there, but just maybe briefly we could talk about this. Otherwise, what kind of, how can we move forward if it's all built on doubt and self-critique or questioning in this matter? I mean, I think it's about certainly having an awareness about, an objective view of the issue and move forward from there. But this stance that we have today, that it's a tremendous doubt and kind of guilt over every conceivable thing. People are alive, Europeans are alive today, over all the things that supposedly our ancestors did. Otherwise, what kind of world are we building? Is this to get kind of a mental stronghold on the Europeans, do you think? Is this a kind of an attack on their culture and heritage and yes. Ethnicity, ultimately?
Yes, I think so, that Europeans have done too many great things. We talked about this in the first interview. They have done too many great things, and so the egalitarians really don't know what to do other than to make Europeans repent for having been so great. They won't say it that way. In a sense, they're asking them to apologize for their own greatness. I think that when people keep demanding apologies, or when they talk directly about the head tax, there's nothing wrong with the answer that, so what, there was a head tax, it doesn't matter to me. Sometimes I talk like that to the students about things that the Europeans may have done in the past, whether it is even the slave trade. I don't belabor the point, because I know everybody else is doing that. So I talk about the greatness that was entailed in creating empires, and some of the leaders and great men that were involved, like Francis Drake and others that were involved in these kinds of activities, about their character, their personalities, what it takes to achieve these things. So it's a way of turning the tables and saying, I'm not necessarily going to talk back about the Chinese, but what I'm going to do is that I'm going to simply not buy into this guilt, and I will say at some point, so it doesn't matter, I'm not interested.
Well, I mean, we have to recognize, if we look at it objectively, that slavery and conquest has been a universal tradition throughout human history, and that is not selective to the Europeans, you know?
Yes.
Maybe just briefly we can talk about the settlers in Canada as well, and actually what they achieved and what they managed to build up there, because it is a far different story, including the United States, of course, America, when Europeans arrived there, when there was hardly any infrastructure in any of these areas. In some cases, they built their own, homes from the ground up with what was available at the time. The kind of immigration that we're seeing into Europe and Canada and America today, it's quite different if we look at what was achieved there. And I'm amazed that the fact that the Europeans are not getting more credibility for what they managed to accomplish and achieve when they came to these areas and built something new in these areas that wasn't there previously, you know?
Yeah, you have to look at the books that were written in the 19th century, and I would say the first decades of the 20th century. When you read those books, historians do talk in an admiring way about what the settlers did in the past, the pioneering spirit, the hardships, the way they struggle and endure so many things. And then around the 70s into the 80s, you see a new group of historians that are shifting the focus towards what whites did to restrict immigration, how workers suffered, how women were not equal to men, and I mean, this goes on and on and on, and we are still in that stage, if you like, stage of thinking. See any major pushback against this Marxist way of thinking, and the generation that is coming out of the university right now is still being educated this way, and so there needs to be a kind of pushback whereby, because I don't know how a nation can survive without certain mythologies, and I call them mythologies because you're not preoccupied with every fact and every detail. You may even romanticize what the settlers did, but I just don't see how a nation can survive without a mythology of its past, without a sense that there were some great men in the past, without having always simply look at their flaws. Or you can look at the flaws, because I think the flaws add character and add to the complexity and make these people even more interesting, but not the way in which it's done today, as if flaws per se are something that need to be overcome because we need to create this docile, domesticated type of individuals that are going to create a better society, which I don't think will be the case. It's kind of a horrible society.
Yep, exactly. Now, I think it's very much about controlling the cultural framework again for people, controlling this debate and rewriting the past in order to control the present, to make ultimately, I think, a psychological impact on the people so that they will kind of, well, weaken, to be honest, in the process. I mean, this is even true in my country, in Sweden, where something the academics and everything else are vehemently struggling, of course, to try to make their point, but in any way they can, they try to demonize the native Swedes, that we pushed out that tribe with this tribe. We've had thousands of years of infighting. There were hundreds and hundreds of different peoples in the Scandinavian region, but yet to this day they're trying to, some even academics claim that we're not native to this region and whatnot, and which is just utter nonsense, of course. But this is kind of the debate that's going on, and I think that is to make that psychological impact on people so that they will weaken, and they will ultimately give up to the state and the control mechanism and just kind of yield to everyone else to run over them. And that's very unfortunate, I think.
Yes, because, I mean, it is really amazing that the argument that Canada, the United States, and Australia are immigrant nations was made, and at least that argument carries some weight that you need to counter in a serious way. But that argument has now been extended to European nations. Just now, one of the next articles I'm about to post in the website is the German philosopher Jürgen Habermas. I mean, this guy is known as one of the great thinkers of our time, and it really is amazing the way he tries to argue that Germany, too, is an immigrant nation. And he wants to make this argument because he wants to justify the opening of German borders and allowing for more and more immigrants to come in. And when you look at the details of his argument, it's just terrible. I mean, one of them is that, after the eastern side collapsed, many foreigners, he calls them, and immigrants from the eastern side came into West Germany. So clearly that means that Germany is an immigrant nation. I mean, really, that's one of the arguments. In other words, when the Eastern Germans came to West Germany, that shows that that's part of it being an immigrant nation. Another argument he makes is that after the Second World War, many Germans, he doesn't say it explicitly because he wants to create a bit of confusion and to create the impression that these immigrants were coming into Germany, but after the Second World War, many Germans that were inhabiting in Eastern European lands and in Russia were forced to get out, to move out of there and go back into Germany. Well, that made Germany even more ethnically German, because the Germans that were outside Germany were forced to go back into Germany. So that's not an argument to say that Germany is an immigrant nation, but he makes these kinds of arguments. And I think these arguments now being made about Britain, about Spain, about France.
It's horrible. I mean, Germany has been under ferocious attack, I'd say, like no other European nation, at least in the 1900s. We had quite a few of good attacks, actually, on Sweden in the 1700s with the Great Northern War, and where we were basically, you know, the Germany of the 1700s as opposed to the 1900s. But what's happening in these countries now, of course, with replacement-level migration, this is an ongoing cultural suicide that actually is happening, and a lot of these people in power, in place, they are willfully doing this, and I still can't figure out if it's just an ideological basis, if they actually just believe that this is the best thing, you know, for these nations, if they're getting, you know, bribed or whatever is going on that level. But you brought something really up in your book, Ricardo, in the beginning, where you looked at the UN report, and maybe we could just tie that in quickly here. It was actually a UNESCO report, History of Mankind, Cultural and Scientific Developments, Volume 1, Prehistory and the Beginning of Civilization. And I believe that there was an argument made there that basically it's through kind of a cultural diffusion, which is at that time, if we look back to our prehistory, where we kind of see an invading force coming in, and out of that you created kind of a new civilization. And in their view, I believe that they think that this is what caused greatness in some cases. So it seems to me, if we look at this report that I believe was released in the 60s, that they got this idea of, like, let's experiment and let's try to kind of mash and just slam all these different cultures into each other with immigration, mass immigration. And so do you think that out of this they believe that some kind of higher civilization of that has an invigorated creativity will arise? Or what's the fundamental basis in this, do you think?
Well, after the Second World War and what happened in Germany, Western scholars came to associate any argument for ethnic identity on the part of Europeans as being Nazi-like and something to be avoided. And together with that, they came to emphasize this notion that what made nations in the past great were their interactions with other nations. So this idea that civilizations and cultures have interacted with each other through trade, through migrations of peoples, and even through war, they utilize this idea to then advance the notion that ever more diversity and interaction must be good, and this is the way to go. So in the 60s, you see this in many writings. I was just reading a book on Greece by Will Durant, you know, the guy that wrote that multi-volume history, one massive volume after another.
Yep.
On the history of the West. And it actually, that volume that I'm talking about, which is just on ancient Greece, it's an incredible book. It's a great book. It's better than the books that are written today. And he recognizes the uniqueness and the incredible achievements of the Greeks. So in the 60s, people are still recognizing these things. But here and there, you see on his part this notion that the Greeks were great because they were more open-minded and more willing to interact with other cultures. And there is truth to this. I mean, there is no question, and I do make this argument in my book, that one of the unique characteristics of Western civilization is that they were willing to learn from, to read about, and to investigate the ways of other peoples. And you learn from that. So that's an openness that I think is a good thing. But from that idea, after the 60s and today, and you see this in Habermas as well, the idea has been extended that the true, the best form of diversity is to bring a bunch of immigrants from all kinds of cultures into your own homeland. Durant was not making this argument. Will Durant was not making this argument. No one was really making this argument, or few were making this argument in the 1960s. This is an argument that you see now pervasive in the academic world. Habermas, he says that. He says, you know, one of the things that characterizes a liberal enlightened culture is a willingness to question, to reflect about their norms, rather than to close in and just kind of to stick with the way things have been done. And so this idea, which people read, they say, okay, yeah, that makes sense. You don't want someone who doesn't want to open their eyes to any other way of life and so on, and doesn't want to interact with foreigners and that sort of thing. But from this idea, then he jumps into the idea that, oh, well, that means that Germany should be bringing many Turkish people, many African, and that's just going to really keep enriching them, which is just nonsense, because the Enlightenment itself, which came out of Europe, came out of non-immigrant nations.
Yeah.
Greece, what it achieved, came out of the Greeks themselves. And Will Durant recognizes that. He's not a cultural Marxist, I would say. Yeah, you have to follow through this debate and see how it is that legitimate ideas about interaction and the benefits of learning about the Japanese or learning about the Chinese, that these ideas have now been polluted with notions that Vancouver is just now a better place with 40% Chinese population that we have there. So, yeah, that's totally different.
Well, exactly, and I mean, it's an attack on all kinds of, or any level of tradition, basically. And I would say it's quite different as well if you look at the ancient world and the migration waves that occurred, sometimes due to, you know, resources and climate, climactic changes and everything else. That scenario, although it did entail warfare in certain cases and conquest flat out, it's quite different than how it's done today with basically paperwork and laws and these bureaucrats sitting in their ivory towers looking at numbers and statistics and getting a grand idea that, oh, to invigorate, you know, Europe or whatever, we need to do this. I mean, I don't think that there's ever been a point of stagnation, to be honest. I think that this is actually done in reverse. This is actually to quench the source, to remove the spirit of Europe to a certain extent. I don't know if you would agree with that, Ricardo, but do you think that there is their stance, that they are, in their belief, they're trying to make it more energetic in a creative culture, or is there something more sinister going on behind it?
I mean, clearly, there are many levels. It depends on whose ideas you're looking at within the cultural Marxist camp. Not all of them think alike, or not all of them understand what they're doing in the same way.
That's right. Yeah.
Some people that are very naive, they think this is good for humanity. There's some people that are kind of cynical, are taking pleasure in watching whites apologize and just commit suicide. So it depends on who you're looking at. But from an intellectual point of view, from the point of view of various books that I have read on this matter, I would say that there's a lot of willful confusion. You mentioned the fact that there were migrations in the past. For example, in the case of England, the Romans had come in there. Other ethnic groups from the Nordic regions had also come there, the Vikings and so on. So today, people make reference to these kinds of ethnic movements into and outside of England as a way of saying that what is happening today is a natural continuation of those migratory movements. But they're radically different. For one, these are the ones that happened in ancient through medieval times in England, are intra-European movements. They're movements by people that have very close ethnic relationships.
Yes.
Also, in the case of medieval and modern times, religious similarities. For another, they happen through a long period of time. Nothing like what you're seeing today in England, which is a matter of the last few decades. For another, or another difference is that those movements in the past were actually very violent. So you can't use them to defend multiculturalism and immigration today. If anything, you can use them to indicate, look, these things create tension and they happen through violence, so that may well happen later on.
Exactly.
Right, and then the final point I would make is that what is happening today is something, as you mentioned, is a program from above by elites. It's a calculated program to create a future state of affairs. That never was the case. It's not like in England, people sat down and said, okay, let's bring the Viking, that's going to make us more diverse. Yeah, nobody did that. Whereas today, it was done in a conscious effort, and as I said before, it depends on who you look at. Members of the Labour Party, it has been revealed in a very sinister way, actually said we will bring diversity in order to increase our votes and decrease the possibilities of future conservative governments. So, yeah, very different.
Well, indeed, exactly. I mean, I would argue that even Celts and Scandinavians were closely related. And, of course, later when Angles and Saxons go over to Britain, you know, I mean, they were right in the region of northern Germany, southern Denmark right there. And then that is Scandinavians right there. So it was practically the same with very similar traditions and everything else. What's happening now is now you have these very established cultures that have existed for many thousands of years that have distinct, you know, different religions and cultural backgrounds and everything. And now taking that and mushing and smashing that together is going to cause a lot of conflict. And the fact is, we've seen this in the past. We've seen it with modern examples with the riots that have occurred practically in every European nation now. With most recently, we had one last year in Sweden. You know, so I think we're going to see more and more of this. And I think that Europe hasn't really realized what they have brought upon themselves, Ricardo.
Yes, and the other point I would add is that there are many people that oppose immigration on the part of radical Muslims because they think that they're the ones that assimilate least or don't assimilate and bring very different values and they create violence and so on. But I still think, and this is one of the reasons why I have explore immigration into Vancouver, it doesn't matter if the people that come in are peaceful and even add economically to the city of Vancouver, because when you look at pure economic indicators, there is no question that the economy of Vancouver has benefited. I mean, not everyone has benefited. And it's a complicated argument because the middle classes in Vancouver, the European middle classes, have suffered due to an incredible increase in the prices of houses. And in other ways, they have benefited. But let us say that you can bring up a number of indicators that show that the city of Vancouver has benefited economically. To me, that's still not an argument for immigration. And one of the things that I'm doing with my blog, which is called Council of European Canadians, is that I think Europeans need to affirm their identity for its own sake, because it is valuable, because it matters to them, because it is ultimately the deepest form of historical identity. The formation of ethnic characteristics took place through thousands and thousands of years. So if you erase that, you're erasing the deepest historical identifier of your people. And so it's very important for them to say that this is something that I value for its own sake. And I'm not going to buy into all these corporate economic arguments as to how it is that growth accelerated and how it is that the number of people employed has increased and so on. So this is something that I try to do in my blog.
Well, indeed, exactly. Council of European Canadians, the website for that is eurocanadian.ca. We're going to give out that in a little bit as well. We have a few more minutes here before we're going to wrap up the first segment, Ricardo, and I thought we could go into a little bit more on the situation in Canada before we break and talk about the type of model, I guess, that has arisen in Canada. I know that recently you wrote about Charles Taylor, for example, that's going now around and kind of arguing for the type of model and of immigration and multiculturalism in the European countries that have arisen in Canada. And I guess they considered this to be a very successful one at that. But what are we looking at? Is the situation, you would say, in Canada distinctly different than in other European nations or America?
Well, the Canadian model is different because, for one, Canada does have that history of European peoples from the outside arriving here, and so it has that immigrant quality to it. Of course, I don't accept the notion that Canada is an immigrant nation, and we can talk about that later, but it has that aspect that is immigrants from Europe did come here in high numbers through the 19th century after the initial settlers had created the basic institutional and economic structures that you then call Canada, that you then identify as a nation. So immigrants did come through the 19th century. And then when multiculturalism was introduced in the early 1970s, and ever since then, we have had many immigrants arrive here, and there is a sense in which Canadians kind of accepted the idea that Canada is about immigrants, that Canada can have a true multicultural state of affairs. We don't have to affirm one culture, be it the British culture, because already from the beginning, not only did we have numbers of immigrants coming from Europe, but the nation was sort of composed of two basic ethnic identities, the French and the English, and various mechanisms. There was a recognition that these two peoples were the founding peoples of Canada. So then when multiculturalism comes in later, it's a matter of, okay, we have these aborigines here before, we have two founding peoples, we had immigrants from Germany, from Russia, Scandinavia, and so on. And so now we're going to have immigrants from other areas, and we're going to create a multicultural society, and the public, and the media, and the schools, they sort of embrace this idea, and they came to embrace it as if this is what is unique about Canada. When you read Charles Taylor, who is a very prominent philosopher in Canada, and you read many others, including, what is his name, Anthony Giddens, who is an English sociologist, he makes this argument that Canada is the quintessential multicultural immigrant nation of the world. They have embrace multiculturalism and diversity in a way that no other nation has, and they have implemented certain policies and institutional changes that have created this truly multicultural nation, and it is working, they're rightful there, they integrate, and the nation is doing so well. And so Charles Taylor and others and Will Kim Leacock came to formulate the arguments to justify and rationalize the system of multiculturalism. And Charles Taylor and Kim Leacock, especially Kim Leacock, they were traveling continuously to Europe, to Germany, to England, France, Spain, selling the Canadian model of multiculturalism. So yes, Canada has, it's almost as if that has become the identity of Canada. So for me, it is important to challenge this model, this best model of multiculturalism, because if you can challenge it, then you can challenge any other model, since they're not seen as being as good as the Canadian model. And also the arguments that have been presented by Kim Leacock and Charles Taylor are seen as possibly the best arguments ever presented in favor of immigrant multiculturalism. And so I have been writing about that and trying to show that those arguments are actually really inadequate, and that they are not within the tradition of liberalism, as they claim, but actually are cultural Marxist arguments.
Well, exactly. By the way, Anthony Giddens, of course, he actually served as the director of the London School of Economics to 97 to 2003, which is, of course, a school that came directly out of the Fabian Society, the Fabian Socialist Society, where he now is the emeritus professor, by the way. Well, we know about their gradualist objective to transform and use, I would say, the Western civilization and turn it into an engine for international, you know, Marxism. So people need to be aware of what kind of political agendas lie behind the type of people, you know, we're talking about here, and how they seek to transform, you know, our culture, Ricardo. But we can comment a little bit more on that, and of course many other aspects that we have to add to this after the break. There's just so much more I want to ask you about and talk about. But let's give out your website again, and also tell us, give us the book title, Ricardo, and tell us where people can go to pick up copies of the book.
Well, the book that I wrote is called The Uniqueness of Western Civilization. There is a soft cover. It has been around, I think, for a year or so now. And they can buy it in Amazon or directly in Braille. And then this, if you just write my name, actually, and would be cited Council of European Canadians, you hit the website, and you see there already quite a number of articles. They're not all by me. There are other people who have written, including a PhD student here at University of New Brunswick. Her name is Claire Ellis. And there are other people like Tim Murray who have written as well. One of the things that I really want to do in this website is that I do want to concentrate on developing arguments. There are other websites already that bring in news about the failures of immigration, multiculturalism, or like American Renaissance. They concentrate on the lack of integration of blacks and whites in the United States, or the Occidental Observer. They focus on the Jewish question, and then you have others like counter-currents who are more into the New Right philosophy and other political issues. One of the things I want to do in my website is that I want to look at the best arguments that have been presented for immigration and multiculturalism, and try and show that these arguments are really flawed, and that they have many assumptions and concepts that are inserted or introduced as if they were part of the European liberal tradition, and they are not. They are alien concepts that are being superimposed from the outside, if you like, in a rather misleading and I might even say, well, really deceptive manner, because they're not concepts that come out naturally from the Enlightenment or naturally from liberal thinkers in the past. It is important for me to say that we don't need to throw away the European past, the Enlightenment, and liberalism. There are people that are getting frustrated, and they're saying, well, you know, liberalism is to be blamed. Now, loosely speaking, yes, you can use the term liberalism to refer to even cultural Marxists and leftists and so on. But in a strict sense, when you look at the writings of John Locke and Hobbes and people coming from the Enlightenment, I just don't see in their writings, when they're talking about individual rights, I don't see them arguing that if you acknowledge that individuals have rights that should be protected, that it follows that European nations must extend these rights to everyone in the world, and therefore that Germans should potentially view Africans as individuals with rights who should somehow be allowed into Germany because they also have rights.
Right.
So I don't see that coming out of the liberal tradition. I think this is an argument that is coming out of the cultural Marxists. And so just to end on this point, one of the things I'm trying to do in the blog is to really debate the best, that is how they're seen, the best thinkers coming in favor of immigration and multiculturalism, and showing that we can defeat them in terms of arguments. We can show that we have the better arguments. They don't have the better arguments. They just suppress the ability of critics to present their arguments. But now with the internet, we can present our arguments and really defeat them.
Well, exactly. Very good. I definitely agree with that. I think this is the elite's plan to fulfill their own agendas, and unfortunately a lot of perhaps naive but good-intended people have fallen for this strategy, which is not at all has their best interest at heart. So it's very important for people to wake up to this and question this and realize why the mainstream and all the academic circles are pushing this line of thinking. It's definitely about time. All right, the website again here, eurocanadian.ca. It's the Council of European Canadians, and of course, Ricardo Duchesne, last name. I can spell that for you guys in case you want to search right now. D-U-C-H-E-S-N-E, Ricardo Duchesne. And the book is The Uniqueness of Western Civilization. Comes highly recommended. I've been enjoying it for a long time. A lot of good stuff in the book, so I do encourage you guys to pick up a copy of the book. All right, Ricardo, stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break. We'll continue with more. Our website is redicecreations.com, where you'll find a whole lot more. And our members' website is redicemembers.com, where we are going to return after the break for a second hour. We'll speak more about the left, center, right spectrum of politics and how virtually all the parties and all political blocs across the board are all on the same page when it comes to the immigration policy. We discuss the rise of the anti-EU parties in Europe as well as a positive sign. We talk about economic liberalism and empty materialism as a plague on previously homogenous nations. We talk about wage dumping, globalization, and internationalism for the sake of the monetary returns. We continue further to speak about the evidence that points in the direction of the ultimate decline of the West. Then we also talk about the points that indicate that there actually is an awakening and we are entering into a completely new, unprecedented era for the West. In the elite's plan of globalism, there is an inherent disadvantage to everybody in the long term that is going to wreak havoc in countries where talented, educated, and more wealthy people are fleeing from. Previously more natural population movements and migration patterns are now replaced with scientific, statistical, live experimentations due to naive choices by some and more sinister agendas by others. Ricardo talks about how tough love is necessary at this point to seize the pattern that we are now seeing. He explains how we have to make some extremely hard and difficult decisions in order to halt the trends that we now are seeing globally. In the extension, he says, this is actually done to help the nations that are exhibiting difficulties. A very interesting and thought-provoking discussion ahead. Please go to redicemembers.com and subscribe if you haven't already, and download or stream this program or any of our previous ones. Thank you for your support so that we can remain free from ads and commercial interruptions. And finally, we have upcoming John Lash, Gary Biltcliff, Max Egan, and a whole lot more coming on after this. All right, we'll see you after the break, everybody. Thank you for staying with us.